Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet. Engage.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation, a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
Adam, I was thinking it has been an awfully long time since we cracked open our Bible.
Oh, yeah. In so many ways, that's the truth, Ben.
It's good to see you all in church.
It's called the Bible.
That's the way God wants it. I don't know why, dude.
All these questions? Is a little blind faith too much to ask?
You got that that red letter edition TNG show Bible over there?
Oh, yeah, the King James show Bible.
Yeah, King Rod show Bible.
I have randomly selected another page from the What Doesn't Work section of the of the book.
Is that half the book?
Sadly, no, Adam.
It's just a single line that says season 7.
These are points 5 through 9, and there's some big headlines and some clarifications. First is, we do not accept stories which are fantasy instead of science fiction. The difference between the two is profound. Despite the fact that both science fiction and fantasy can deal with unusual events, a science fiction story is based on an extrapolation of a generally accepted scientific fact or theory. Fantasy, which our format does not permit, need have no basis in reality.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my retort for that is every holodeck episode ever. It's funny how condescending the show Bible can be sometimes.
Yeah.
In case you didn't know the difference, you guys.
Speaking of holodeck episodes, number 6, we are not interested in swords and sorcery. Knights, princesses, stalwart, yeomen, and dragons are not science fiction for our purposes. I feel like they've done so much of that.
For what purpose did the show Bible serve? Like, was the show Bible on a bookshelf in the writer's room and it was rarely referred to, or were writers expected to observe the rules in it? Because it sure doesn't seem, based on these last two bullet points, that it was something that they took seriously.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely... I mean, I guess all rules are made to be broken.
Sure.
Number 7, don't treat deep space as a local neighborhood. Too often, script ideas show characters bouncing from solar system to solar system, planet to planet, without the slightest comprehension of the distance involved or the technologies required to support such travel. Fine and even fun in Space Rangers, but not Star Trek. What's Space Rangers? Is that something?
You know, the very popular hit science fiction series Space Rangers. I have no idea what that is.
Space Rangers TV series. Wow.
That totally pokes a hole in my proposal for the Cannonball Run TNG episode that we were so close to getting.
Wow, Space Rangers is an American futuristic science fiction drama. It aired on CBS in 1993.
Oh, you know how many shows are on CBS right now that I've never heard of?
I love that the show Bible for a much bigger television series is throwing shade at their competition. good stuff.
Look, man, you wanna write a dragon story? You could take that shit over to Space Rangers. We don't do that around here.
We're running a very classy science fiction television program. Point eight, Star Trek is not melodrama. Melodrama is a writing style which does not require believable people. Believable people are at the heart of good Star Trek scripts.
The second part is true.
Yeah. Like, melodrama is a perfectly valid genre. What the fuck is he talking about? And by he, I obviously mean God, who wrote this.
Especially when the show came out of the blocks. It was almost entirely melodrama.
Yeah. Number nine. Do not consider Klingons, Romulans, or Ferengi the only villains in space. We are determined not to copy ourselves. If, as dramatists say, villains make the story, how about the other fascinating aliens to be found in a galaxy filled with billions of stars and planets?
I think this probably came from a good place. But I think as soon as they wrote the Ferengi and saw them on screen for the first time, they were like, you know, I think we better just keep it in the alien neighborhood we're familiar with. We are not good at this. Yeah. You know what's weird is, like, off the top of my head, I'm trying to think of the aliens they introduced in order. And Ferengi was first, as far as the new aliens go. And then who came next, besides, like, Loaf of the Week?
Yeah, there's been a lot of Loaf of the Weeks. I guess the other big ones introduced in this series are Borgs and Cardassians.
Yeah. Yeah, they did a good job with those two. I mean, Nausicaans.
Yeah. They don't really
actually
present...
had some shit to do. The Farmer Hoggets.
Yeah, the Pakleds.
Yeah, the Pakleds, the Yuridians. But to begin with the Ferengi and miss the way they did, that had to give some people some pause.
Yeah.
But they redeemed themselves on Alien Creation after that, but they did a good job. And they even redeemed the Ferengi.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of wisdom in this Bible.
Do you?
Well, here endeth the lesson, Adam.
Well, peace be with you, Ben.
And also with you, Adam.
What do you say we see to what degree this episode prescribes to those rules? It's Season 7, Episode 16, Thine Own Self.
This is becoming a speech.
You're the captain, sir. You're entitled.
Not entitled to ramble on about something everyone knows.
An episode that begins with Beverly taking a night shift command spot, and the return of Deanna Troi from a 3-day class reunion. Ben, I have so much to talk about with regards to a 3-day class reunion.
Yeah.
What the hell is that about? Like, that does not include transit time, I don't think. I think the event takes 3 days.
God, I was out of shit to talk about in the first 30 minutes at my class reunion.
I went to my 10-year, and my 20-year was a couple weeks ago. I skipped it, Ben, and it was local. It was like 30 minutes away, and I didn't go. That's kind of shitty, right?
You didn't want to tell people about your Star Trek podcast?
The pause that I'm giving between the question and the answer, I think, says a lot. But what is a reunion if not 100 times to answer the question, what have you been up to? That's a question that I hate answering in general. I just didn't want to deal with it.
Yeah.
High school wasn't great for me, TBH.
No, it kind of sucked. I don't want to reconnect with the person I was in high school either. Like,
right.
High school was a very dark time for me.
And the cools in high school have gone on to become way less cool because that's what happens when you graduate. I don't want to... I don't want to start the motor on those egos again. Like, I don't, yeah. I would rather not give them the satisfaction of my attendance, you know, to give them the social standing that they have so missed. Fuck them.
Fuck them.
Anyway, I think Troi liked her classmates a lot more than we did because upon returning to the bridge, she's like, yeah, it was really, you know, she makes the case that everyone does at the end of her reunion. She's like, you know, it's nice to connect with people that I haven't talked to in many years and see, you know, their ambitions realized. Speaking of Bev, what the hell are you doing on the bridge?
Yeah, Beverly is like,
the truth is, I like it. It's not every doctor who gets to command a starship, even if it is the night shift.
Bev is like, it's a good thing every alien in the universe prescribes to a three-shift rotation, and every other hostile alien ship is running their C-team right now, so, like, we're not in any danger. Like, what the hell is that about? This is almost as wacky as the rule of, like, all ships approaching each other from the same plane.
Yeah.
It's weird shift logic.
I mean, one thing that, like, we kind of didn't touch on much in the last episode is that, like, aside from the very end, that was, like, one of the first times we've ever seen an episode where the mission basically goes entirely according to plan.
Yeah.
Like, they go pick up the guy, they, like, get him in the shuttle, and they send him on his way. And, like, you know, it's obviously got a sad ending, but, like, the mission is not where any of the conflict or drama is coming from in that episode. And you have to think that, like, a lot of the time this ship is flying around not encountering space buttholes and stuff, right?
Yeah, and a third of the time the C-team, like, it's a bridge full of Barnabys are running the show for 8 hours a day. Like, outside of the episode Disaster, which this episode refers to fairly directly, what we don't get is the cold open of the C-team getting bangers dropped on them and the senior staff, like, being asleep.
Yeah.
And having to make their way to the bridge or whatever. I think that's a story that's worth retelling.
That would be fun. Yeah. Picard getting knocked out of bed by a banger. Getting on the communicator. What the fuck is going on up there? I go to sleep for 30 minutes and the ship's getting bangers dropped on it.
Barnaby's like, finally, I get to take command.
They're also waiting to hear from Data, who's off on a mission collecting some radioactive material that landed on an uncontacted pre-industrial planet. And they've got some other like shit to do, go to like pick up some medical supplies from somebody or whatever.
Yeah, and just as an aside, Bev is like, yeah, I mean, Data hasn't responded to any of our communiques for like 36 hours or whatever. But
Geordi said that the radiation from the probe might interfere with communications.
We're not worried about our most valuable Federation asset going off the grid for longer than an hour.
Yeah.
Bev like sort of supports her. Like, even Troy is like, you sent him a message and he hasn't responded to any messages for a length of time. Isn't that weird? And Bev's like, yeah, it's cool. We just send him messages even if we aren't sure he's going to open them. I think that's not a good look for Beverly if she is on command duty.
Yeah.
Like, this is basically a Data Amber Alert here situation, and she is not seeing it for what it is.
Yeah, she's much, much more interested in talking about how much she likes being captain deep down.
And you can see this sort of eat at Troy. She sees Bev in the big chair. She sees how satisfying it is to be there.
I like it.
Beverly sort of cops to the idea of like, yeah, I didn't have to become commander. Being doctor was the jam for me, but like, new challenges, right? You get what I'm saying, Deanna. And like, she sort of looks at her pips and is like, oh, I guess you wouldn't.
Sometimes a plant grows too big for its pot, Deanna.
And credit to Marina Sirtis, like, she seems a little crushed by this.
Yeah.
There's a wilting in her flowers.
It's a nice wordless performance.
Yeah.
Cut to Ren Faire.
This is a planet fully inhabited by people with the Mazda logo tattooed to their forehead.
They just love that logo. They all went for the tat.
What is up with this season going with, like, Planet Scottish, Planet Renfair? Like, I'm ready to see Planet Circus.
Yeah.
What are they doing?
I don't know.
They don't have the money for Loaf. They burned it all on costumes.
Like, if you're going to have this storyline, having the aliens be real loafy is A, going to be tremendously expensive, and B, going to make it hard to explain why Data does not have Loaf.
Yeah.
Like, he can have weird skin, but if he doesn't have the Loaf, they're going to be like, there's something very wrong with this guy.
Right. Agreed.
So Data walks into this town square looking like I feel, and he's like, he's got like a 1,000-yard stare, and he's carrying a plastic lunch pail, and this man and his daughter are walking through the square, and they're in, like, you know, Renaissance-y clothing. And the man is like,
"Who are you? What do you want?"
And Data opens his mouth and just like...
Seeing Data with messed up hair evokes a feral Riker idea, but it's far more acute. Like, messed up Data hair is a really bad sign. He's got like scorch marks on him.
Yeah.
There's a big gash across where his communicator would be. He doesn't look great.
No.
And he's not sounding great either. He's sounding like a broken fax machine. But he sort of puts it together, right? Like, the guy, the father, is his name Garvin?
Garvin.
Fred Garvin, male prostitute.
This guy, who we'll get to know later, is Garvin. It's like, "Hey, bud, you okay?" And Data is, like, mimicking him. And slowly, like, his voice is coming back, but only in the sentence fragments that Garvin is shooting at him. Until finally, at the end, Data sort of, like, his brain comes back online insofar as he can say, like, he's sort of putting it together.
The CPU is a neural net processor, a learning computer.
He's fixing himself.
That part is coming back online. But he's lost his memory, and, like, the first indication of this is that Garvin's like, "I'm Garvin, this is Gia.
I have a work order here which specifies that I am to Roger you roundly till 6:15 tomorrow morning."
Data doesn't remember his name. And they're like, "Well, what's in your lunch pail there, buddy? Maybe your wallet's in there." And they're looking at it, and they're like, "Why does it say radioactive? What could that possibly mean?"
They're like, "Your case says Calvin Klein. Maybe that's your name." It's a total Back to the Future thing, I thought.
I've never seen an android in purple underwear.
It's so, like, the way they frame this case, they frame it very ominously, as they do with the radioactive box. But this is something that, like, contemporary science has thought a lot about, like, with regard to the caves where we bury nuclear material, for instance. Like,
how
what
you...
is a thing, what is a symbology that you can use that looks like danger to anyone for the next million years?
Yeah.
Evidently, they have not answered that question.
Not at this point. Don't they do like an image of somebody barfing? Isn't that what they put on those caves?
Yeah. That should be the logo for our podcast.
For a lot of people, it already is, Adam.
That's the next t-shirt idea. Just greatest gen logo, guy barfing.
So that is our A storyline. Our B storyline is Troy, like, having talks with Riker about her newly crystallized ambition to become a 3-pip. And she, like, walks into his quarters while he's practicing the bone.
Ben, how not great would it be to live next to Riker, given his prodigious bone practice?
I was really,
and I mean that in every definition.
I was really wishing that the camera did one of those plunging shots through the floor and just showed like an ensign like hitting the ceiling with a broom handle, one deck down.
God, because you got to believe that the deck that Riker is on is one of the great decks.
Yeah.
Great condos. The floor plans are killer.
You
got to
hope that there's Jeffrey tubes on either side and above and below, because otherwise it's really going to fuck things up for everybody else.
Living next to Riker is like getting the hotel room next to the ice machine and the elevator. You're not going to be doing a lot of sleeping.
That door's going to be slamming every 30 minutes.
Yeah. Man.
I do want to be close enough to the ice machine, though. I hate having to go to another floor for it.
Yeah, you want same floor ice, that's for sure.
That is for damn sure.
Riker's been playing trombone for so long that he has come up with a trombone language that he is speaking with Troy. This is sort of a Wally language that he plays through the trombone.
Is that supposed to be a question?
They're having a lot of fun with this.
You know, this is a much better way of communicating for you. It's far less confusing than the way you normally speak.
This is like the sort of relaxed fun that they have with each other that is just so comfortable.
Yeah. I like, I think at some point he says, like, my Mzadi just came in to make fun of my trombone playing.
Yeah. Yeah, the self-referentialness.
Yeah.
The references to the ball breaking in progress.
Yeah.
The way open V combination that Riker's rocking here.
Yeah.
You want something loose fitting when you're playing that bone.
Yeah. Off hours, gonna put on that loose V. And so Troy says that she wants that 3-pip game. And he says, well, yeah, like, I think you'd be great. But there's a test, and you're going to have to jump through the same hoops as everybody. I'm not going to be nice to you just because you're my Mzadi.
Yeah, he makes that case that you have to make when you work with friends, which is like, this is the work hat, and this is the friend's hat, and I don't often wear both at the same time. So, like, I'm the guy for whom the buck stops on these promotions, so, like, don't expect special treatment.
Yeah, the only hat I wear at the same time as either of these is my Jimmy hat.
Which I just wear all the time.
Just in case.
My dick is not doing any breathing.
It keeps it nice and soft like a glove with lotion in it.
I thought it was funny that Troy referred to her previous experience in command as a disaster. Like, I love references to the title of the episode in the episode.
Yeah.
Riker's like, well, to thine own self be true, Deanna, and then, like, looks at the camera.
It is the guiding principle of a Starfleet base. Have you can't find it within yourself to stand up, tell the truth, you don't deserve to wear that uniform.
Back on Planet Renaissance, a very officious local science lady has been brought around. They've got Data back to the house they live in, and this science lady Talur is assessing Data. Like, she's like looking in his mouth and smelling his breath, and she's trying to get her head around what he might be, because he doesn't look like them, obviously. And she determines, based on the available evidence, that she is talking to an Iceman.
Ice man.
She does that thing where, like, the most wrong people have the strongest opinion about how they're feeling. Like, she is positive that he is an Iceman.
You are an Iceman.
Data's ready to believe this. Like, I'm an Iceman. That's me.
Cool. I'll take your word for it. You seem to be very sure of yourself. Yeah, I kind of wondered what the statement being made here was. Was it that, like, scientists, like, early scientists didn't know what the fuck they were talking about? Because she seems to have, like, some grasp of the universe, but it is a primitive one. And, like, as he gets more plugged back into himself, he starts being much, much better at science than she is. But
the message that it gave me was, like, true intelligence has a doubt component.
Right.
And she looks like a buffoon for not having that.
Have you ever read about E prime?
No. Is that when you get ecstasy delivered to your home on the same day that you ordered it?
Yeah, it's Uber, but for drugs. it's an idea of a version of English for scientists that doesn't have any like certainty words.
Hmm.
You can never say like the word is. You would always have to say like appears to be or
oh.
I perceive something as X. And I guess it's mostly just kind of a thought experiment. Like can you get around in a world where you like are linguistically barred from certainty in anything? But yeah, this woman is brimming with confidence that every pronouncement she makes is true. And there's a great scene where she's like teaching a bunch of little kids about the elements, and she's like,
if we expose the wood to flame, we can encourage the fire within the wood to show itself.
Because look at this! And she lights it on fire. And he's like,
and though it's very hard to see, it's also filled with water. And Data does that smart kid thing where he corrects the teacher.
I do not believe that is correct.
Oh?
Yeah.
She doesn't take this well.
No.
She takes it so not well that I pegged her as a threat to Data right away in a way that later on does not, that ends up being a head fake. Like,
yeah.
Like, she is not the threat to him that I presupposed she would be.
And she sort of is redeemed as the episode goes on. Like, she realizes that he has a lot to offer in terms of, like, understanding of the world around them, she becomes more and more friendly to him.
There's a magic trick this show does, or this television series does from time to time, which is, like, accurately predict something that happens in modern times. And maybe the most acute way that the show has ever done it is predicted the popularity of the name Jaden, which is what they end up naming Data in this episode for lack of any other name. They're like, yeah, let's make you Jaden. Jaden, of course, now, along with every other name that ends in E-N, is like the number one style of name that babies are named right now.
I just picture all the parents listening, being like, "Fuck, this is where I got it from." God, we've been calling our kid this for 6 years. I did not realize it was because I watched a TV show when I was 9.
I watched a C-level season 7 random episode on BBC America.
Must have just slipped into my head.
I think I'd rather have a child named Jaden than Garvin.
Compliments of Great Lakes Feed and Grain.
Or Scorin.
Yeah.
Scorin is the town blacksmith, played by a fairly legendary that guy, Mike Haggerty.
Actually, I was thinking about filing agreements with the union.
Yeah, Mike Haggerty's the best.
He really is. They take the metal from Data's lunch pail down to this guy, and they're like, what do you think of this? And he's like, well, this is some great metal. Like, I don't know how you even make metal this great. It's so shiny. It's so pliable.
Metal is slightly warm.
And so he's like, let me buy some of this off you. I'm gonna make some jewelry.
I know this is not how radioactive metals work, but when he took it over to the blacksmith's table and started whacking on it with a hammer, I was full on expecting, like, cut to extreme wide shot of the town, giant nuclear flash, cut to credit sequence.
How about just cut to view of planet and, like, yeah. A little flash under the clouds and then roll credits?
Oh, man, there's a version of this episode that's 8 minutes long. That would have been great.
Yeah. Well, you know, in movies you can nuke the fridge, but in television shows you can nuke the anvil.
Yeah, what? It is definitely Chekhov's anvil.
Why are guys that work with metal always so gruff?
I think that is what you hire for when you're hiring blacksmiths.
Gruffness?
Yeah.
What is this man's gruffness quotient? Okay, he can work here.
It says here on your resume that you're great at growing a mustache, and sure as hell I can see that. Great job with the mustache. I have some doubts about your gruffness, though.
Mm.
Well, sir, I'm willing to learn. I can. You can train me on the job.
Yeah. I took her advice and I went down to Kmart and got suspenders and a belt, so got that part sorted out.
Man can't even trust his own pants.
I worked on a fishing boat for a couple of summers. That really made me gruff.
One thing that would make me gruff is an anvil falling on my foot, and that happens to Skorin's apprentice, and you know, they're like, shit, like, it's going to take 10 men to lift this thing off you, and Data comes over and very easily picks up this anvil, and rather than writhe in pain at his crushed foot, the apprentice looks up at him in horror.
One of the rare Data feats of strength. Feel like we haven't seen one of these in a long time.
They're fun.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of one at the beginning when he like handed the guy the lunch pail and it was way heavier than it looked.
Right.
But
right.
Yeah, this is great.
Now, when you're building a blacksmith station, you're going to want to be sure to use timber that is not rotten as a base.
We're using pressure treated lumber that should stay nice and hard out here in the elements for a good long time.
I like to give my blacksmith base a nice coat of varnish. Just a couple coats is all you need to keep your base looking glossy for years to come.
We're setting it on a couple of 2x4s on the ground so that it is separated from the slate and therefore can drain on all sides.
So the reaction from shattered ankle guy, I think, becomes emblematic from everyone in town. They've gone from seeing him as a mysterious stranger to there being a little bit of threat creep happening.
Like, right. It goes Iceman, from, we feel weird that you missed the memo about getting the Mazda tattoo, to we're a little unsure of like how okay it is for you to be around.
Yeah.
And that also gets amplified by the fact that Garvin,
the company sent me,
and his daughter and the blacksmith are falling ill slowly.
Where Garvin is in repose is the Sub Rosa house. It's a Sub Rosa house redress.
Oh.
I noticed this with the door initially, and then when they did the reverse shot of Garvin on his fainting couch as he's sick with radioactive poison, the stairway behind him is also Sub Rosa stairway.
Dang, I did not
notice that. So they got value for the set.
Yeah. I suppose if you build the house, you're going to want to use it.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's interesting, you know, how changing the light changes how a set looks so fundamentally, because they shoot very hot light into this set, and it looks totally different from Planet Scotland.
Mm-hmm. There's also significantly
less... They took all the Hummel figurines out, too.
Yeah, and significantly less hazer in the air.
Yeah, Garvin is not sitting on Beverly's jacking seat.
My love is a fever, long and chill for that, which longer nurses the disease.
Back on the ship, Troy is doing her tests, and they've got her in engineering. It's Worf and Geordi, and there's like some kind of warp core malfunction happening, and they keep trying the different things that she suggests, and it's clear that she's kind of like trying to pull from memory, trying to remember how it all plugs into itself, and she fails. The ship explodes, and it's revealed that she's been on the holodeck the whole time.
Congratulations. You just destroyed the Enterprise.
Participating in Kobayashi Mar 2.
That one's better. Riker walks into the scene like a guy who walks into a room that the ceiling is too short in. This is something I've started to detect in Frakes' performance. Like, his neck is always on a swivel. Like, he sort of saunters in, his head's a little wobbly, and then his head just sort of slumps over on his neck. He gives Troy a little bit of counseling here.
Yeah, now he's doing the counseling.
The council shoe is on the other council foot this time. And he's giving her some tough love. He's like, you know, a lot of this techno jargon is pretty important for the test. But, like, you know, it's not just about memorizing the book. Like, you got to start making some decisions. You got to start thinking deeply about some things during the test. And Troy's like, what are you talking about? Like, the book is like a telephone book full of things. You're encouraging me to think about things besides that. Like, give me a hint. And Riker's like, look, that it's not about hints. I'm not that kind of teacher that gives open book tests. You're just going to have to keep taking the test or, like, maybe reconsider this whole idea.
It's not super dissimilar from the kind of bossing that Worf was doing in the last episode where
right.
It's kind of making the person rise to the occasion by being tougher on them than maybe they're used to.
Yeah.
And in being that tough, like revealing something that the boss has, you know, realized about their potential.
The tension here is played perfectly because I think a weaker show would have dialed them up into full-on open fight about this.
Yeah.
But they never stop treating each other with respect and love. Riker is being real with her, and she is very frustrated by the process, but she's never like, fuck you and fuck this test. Like, I'm going to go take it on the hood where I know I can pass. Yeah. DeSoto, all he gives is open book tests.
Yeah, you can bring your cell phone in here.
He's like flipping through his pad, like feet up on the desk, like not even paying attention to what's happening.
Yeah, he gets on FaceTime with some Ferengis and he's like, hold that thought. And he presses mute and then he goes on like Wikipedia and looks up Ferengis. What the fuck are these guys?
DeSoto is not a Mr. Hand type. I feel like the A and the B story here have about equal weight, and I'm equally invested in both of them.
Yeah, they're both moving. You know, one doesn't seem like your vegetables, and the other like your dessert. It's all they're very like disconnected, but they're both invested with, you know, tension and stakes and interest, and. Right. And the stakes in the town that Data is in are getting pretty high because Garvin is like really sick and Talur is trying, you know, her best to figure out what the fuck is going on, but like she just doesn't have a lot of context. And Data from first principles is like has like invented a microscope, has determined that there is something that's not like a communicable disease, but something that is affecting the cells in people's bodies. Like he's done a lot, and he even shows her an experiment where he like put lamp oil on a piece of fabric in a frame and shows that like he can light it up by holding a candle next to it, but also by holding one of these metal pendants to it.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me that this sucker is nuclear?
And he can make the light go away if he puts the lunch pail in between the pendant and the frame. It's a cool experiment.
It's a trick.
No. It is empirical data.
He really blows Talur's mind here.
She's like, fuck, that's an awesome science experiment. I should try and do one of those.
Talur, up to this point, has been brimming with that false confidence that we referred to in the beginning. But as soon as she runs her hand through Garvin's hair and a big patch of it comes out, all of that false confidence falls away and it scares her. And in the absence of being sure about what's happening, like she fairly instantaneously levels her sight on Data as the thing that may be causing this, as the variable.
Yeah.
She's threatened by him because he is the variable, but also because he intimidates her with his intelligence. He's so fast and he's up to speed so quickly. He's basically taking her job.
Yeah, but she's like that hubris has gone away. She's like really interested in learning something from him. And yeah. She realizes that she has something to learn from him. Meanwhile, the town metal guy is like, this guy made us all sick. We were fine, and then he showed up, and now we all have gross lesions all over our face. So I'm going to put on my angry villager hat and show up with my guy with a pick and punish Jaden for what he has done to us.
This has happened to Riker a lot. Riker goes on away missions to distant planets, and by the time he leaves, its inhabitants are covered in crotch lesions. But yeah, this is totally like townspeople from Frankenstein style, like mob with torches.
The guy with the pick takes a swing at Data, and it gets him on the side of the face, and a like Terminator 2 level amount of skin is ripped away, and the Christmas tree lights and machinery underneath is revealed.
I wish we saw for just a half a second the cut to the floor of that piece of face hitting the ground. like the Foley work is just like a half a pound of ham.
It's so insane to think that if you took all of Data's skin off, he'd be like a Christmas tree under there. Like, why all the lights under the skin?
Yeah.
What are
those
for?
Why can't you see the lights under his skin?
Yeah, I guess it's like perfectly opaque.
Pretty great complexion.
Yeah, that's a very high sun protection factor on that skin.
Yeah.
I am the cutest of all. There are four lights.
So Troy is studying real, real hard. She's like really hitting the books. She's like, I am going to figure out this fucking engineering test if it kills me. And Riker, like kind of unannounced, just barges into her room and is like, hey, like you're wasting your time. You're not going to pass the test. So I'm canceling the whole situation. You're not going to become a commander.
This moment felt fairly cruel in a way that did not seem in character for Riker.
Yeah.
And what it does is it encourages Troy to go right back into the test. Like she turns on the holodeck and goes back in. It made me think that this was fairly similar to the lesson that Worf taught Sito.
Yeah, this is that classic trope of she kind of got the answer from him, but like it took him being really mean to her.
Yeah.
Like he says, like, I can't let you on that bridge because my first duty is to the ship. And she's like, first duty is to the ship? That's it.
Right.
And even though we know this is a simulation, this scene that follows is really intense because she basically has like an eye-to-eye conversation with Geordi, like, hey, can you go sacrifice yourself for the needs of the many?
He would never survive the radiation.
I know that.
This was a great scene because of that. Like, you get the moment. You get the moment that this whole test is about, which is, will you order someone that you know and like to their death? But where the test fails, if I were writing this test, you got to make Geordi fight this.
Yeah, I think I could.
Geordi's got to be like, don't do this, Deanna. Like, I've got so much to live for. Like, send an exocomp, send Data. But not me. Like, I want to live. And then, like, Geordi grabs Troy by the shoulders. I want to live! Like, that's the test on all Madden mode. And that's what I wanted to see. Like, as it was, Geordi's like, aye, aye. And then, like, goes into the Jefferies tube and dies.
This is a real bummer, Deanna, but I suppose.
I would ordinarily say to take care of my stuff or whatever, but I don't have any stuff. So I have a feeling you'll turn over my condo pretty easily. But there's a darkness to the cold efficiency in which Geordi accepts the order and goes and dies, which is something that of itself is powerful. I wonder if they did toy with his reactions in this scene, though, and like heighten the emotion of it.
Like what you're talking about, like a lot of pushback is probably not something that they had time for in the ep, but it is, it's like despite all of the shortcomings of how this is executed, it's still really rough, and it's clearly affecting her a lot. Like, she feels terrible having to do this.
There's a quick cut to Worf in this scene where he knows too, and that's fairly devastating. Like, like everyone knows what she's done. And to Worf's credit, he says nothing. He knows Geordi's about to die a warrior's death.
Yeah.
In a huge amount of pain, being bombarded with radiation.
He should be like, Geordi, awesome, dude. Awesome.
Hey, Geordi. That's what I'm going to be doing for you later. give you one of those warriors that's coming. You know how I do that, right?
You've seen season two, right?
Hey, Geordi, you may want to take off that uniform before going in there. Those things are expensive.
It's going to get messy. Riker walks in and he's like,
congratulations, you passed.
I know that wasn't easy for you, but I'm super impressed.
And relief washes over her in an awesome wave.
Yeah. It's another getting promoted because somebody had to die. In two episodes, that's happened twice.
That's really the dark truth of serving aboard this ship, is that's basically how promotions happen.
Yeah.
We've seen it from the beginning.
You don't get Worf a tactical without Yar.
Yeah.
Well, Data's cracked the code, and he's even come up with a medicine that he can give to fix everybody's radiation poisoning.
An anti-radiation syrup that also tastes good? Data, that's amazing!
And he's like, the only way I can get everybody to drink this, because nobody trusts me, is to go pour it into the town well. Nothing suspicious about that.
This is an insane plan. Data's like, look, because I'm so terrifying to look at, I will cloak myself in this hood and robe, making me look like some sort of ninja. I will stand dramatically above the well and pour the contents of this bucket inside, this unguarded well.
Yeah.
Not a great plan.
No.
Jaden. And sure as shit, the townspeople see him just at the moment that he's ready to pour. And they threw and threw him with a spear.
Yeah.
And he does, like, they shoot this from above, so you get his fall under the ground. It's a super compelling action scene here. Like, there's not a lot of shots and cuts, but it's the angle that sells it. And the sound of when he hits the ground, that metal pipe hitting the brick.
Yeah, I felt bad that Mike Haggerty grabbed that metal and got electrocuted. Poor guy. He doesn't understand what's going on.
That's got to be such a fun test for an actor. Like, act electrocuted a lot. Like, don't worry about looking silly. We'll cover you up with After Effect lightning bolts. Any Oscar-winning actor will tell you, you don't want to go full electrocution.
I heard Mike Haggerty is such a method actor that he wanted real lightning bolts. Anything we can do to increase the amount of danger to me personally?
Oh, that Mike Haggerty's perfect. That's one of your best impressions.
Oh, I love that guy. So the next day, or maybe like 6 months later, it's not really clear. Gia is walking around in the town square having a sad, and up walks to her a bearded man and a red-headed woman, and they say, hey, we have a weird-looking friend who you may know as the Iceman. Can you point us in his direction?
And the direction he points is to a grave. It's like, yeah, he's in there. He's got a spear in him. That's why the box is so big that we buried him in.
Yeah, I know that guy. He dead.
He's dead, but not before he saved us all.
Yeah.
Anyway.
He's got kind of like a hero monument grave. Not just any grave.
Here lies Calvin Klein.
They realize they can beam him up, like, out of the ground, and nobody will ever know. I love
the
idea.
They've been doing a lot of graveyard beam ups lately this season.
I love the idea that, like, hundreds of years in the future, some, like, historian is looking into this, and I was like, I wonder if that was a robot from another planet. We should dig that up and look into it. And they dig down, and there's just nothing there. Like, what did they make it up? What the fuck?
I love the idea that they're, you know, buried in this series is another series that's sort of like Quantum Leap, where Data goes from planet to planet, dies on everyone, and then gets beamed out of his coffin at the end. Like, that could be a thing every time. So they beam him up to the Enterprise and they boot him up. Turns out he's going to be okay.
Yeah, I was a little unclear about how his memory worked here, because he lost everything from showing up in the town to getting killed, but he has back everything from before that. Like, the mechanics of amnesia are always so crazy on television, you know?
The mechanics of mechanical amnesia, especially.
They had to cut out the part of the script where he lost his memory from getting bonked on the head by a coconut and then got it back from getting bonked on the head by another coconut.
Like, Data's face was ripped off, and they put his face back together no problem. Did they have, like sort of like when you go to a fabric store, you got those bolts of fabric. Do they have Data's skin just, like, ready for patches whenever they need to? Or does he have a boss scar in his chest where that spear went through? There's Data damage continuity problems here that like they don't solve for how they're able to do this.
He can make his hair grow. Maybe he can make his skin grow.
They have the technology on this show to show that.
Yeah. They just show him eating a bunch of, like, chicken skin. He's like, yeah, I just need a little bit of this, and then I'll have enough resources to...
I produce my own collagen by eating bone broth. that's fun. Did you like this episode, Ben?
I love this episode. I think it's so much fun. It's a great Star Trek as a place. It's fun. It's got a fun button where Troy tells Data that he now has to call her Sir. It's just it's interesting, you know. It's very interesting to see them interact with less advanced peoples in ways, and I love the trick that this episode has of getting around it just being another Prime Directive retread.
Yeah.
It's just...
Yeah, they get around it by not bringing it up at all.
Yeah, it's great.
That's how you do it.
Yeah.
This episode had equal parts things that I liked and equal parts things that I didn't. I really like careerism as portrayed on the show. I liked seeing the nuts and bolts of someone making a career and deciding that they're going to be ambitious and all of the elements of that make up Troy's decision. I thought that was really cool. I like the test. I did not like Renfair. I do not like, you know, just in general, people in period costume is a thing that I don't like on this show at all. And I don't like the Doctor character was a real caricature, and so that was a weak point. But the episode as a whole, like, it exceeded the parts that drug on it, and I really liked it. It was fun.
Yeah.
Ben, you know what else is fun?
Priority One messages are always fun.
Every single time.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Adam, our first Priority One message is of a personal nature. It's from Kevin, and it's for Ryan. It goes like this. Ryan, thanks for introducing me to this dumb podcast. Hey, this birthday message is arriving super late, and you're so far behind on the pod that you might not even hear it until Christmas. It doesn't matter! I want you to have a happy birthday now! Now, 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 now!
What a delight!
That's good stuff.
Nice callback.
Yeah.
Ben, our second priority one message is from Nick. It is for the letter J. And by that, I just mean J. Like, that's who it's for.
Yeah.
Message goes like this. Everyone knows a juggling festival is a terrible place to meet your future spouse. But what our marriage presupposes is, maybe it isn't. I'm eternally grateful that you braved the shuttlecraft trip to the anti-gravity conference, as even Kevin Uxbridge could not have envisioned a more perfect partner. P.S. Happy Secret Day, my love.
Aww.
The positivity of a Royal Tenenbaums reference and the darkness of a Kevin Uxbridge reference all in one.
Yeah. Yeah, I got the bends hearing that P1 message.
It's a good reference sandwich, Nick. Well, if you're interested in making a sandwich of your own, of references or otherwise, you can go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. Personal messages are $100. Commercial messages are $200. They're a great, great way to help the ongoing production of our program. Hey, Ben?
What's that, Adam?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible. Drunk Shimoda!
I did. I think that the character having the most fun and being the silliest in this episode is Riker. The trombone scene is just so great. Like, it's just another, like, Frakes just fucking chewing up a scene.
Yeah.
And, like, it's so endearing. Like, it's one of those Star Trek moments that I like forget exists, and every time I see it, it's like newly delightful to me.
Yeah, it's the sort of thing that if you're just reading the script, this wouldn't pop, and it might feel in danger of being ham and cheese.
Yeah.
But it's totally redeemed by their performance. Like, a Frakes pulls this off and pulls it out of the heap in such a great way.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Pretty awesome. Did you have a drunk Shimoda, Adam?
I did, and my Shimoda goes to the healer of the village, Talur.
Yeah.
She is who I'd like to call, like, leech confident. Like, back when leeches were used as a medical device, like, the people
who used
them were...
Hey, man, leeches are coming back.
They were so confident about the leeches back in the day. They're like, look, you clearly have leprosy, but I'm going to stick 20 leeches down your pants, and we're going to get you fixed right up.
I love that she decides that his fluidic temperature is too high when he has burn marks from the radiation.
Yeah, like her confidence is Shimoda-like to me, and that read to me as very emblematic of mascot here. So I'm giving mine to Talur.
Nice.
Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra.
When I was growing up, I didn't have anyone to tell me about personal grooming. I had to learn these things on my own. So I'm here to save you some embarrassment and recommend the grooming tools that I use, the products from Manscaped. Now, this is a company that constantly has its mind on your bush. Imagine the meetings they have. Imagine the pictures they have in their PowerPoint presentations. Now imagine your junk looking its best thanks to the Lawnmower 5.0. This thing is the latest bunch trimming technology. With two interchangeable heads, a standard one for taking just a little off the top, and a new foil blade to go smooth wherever your heart desires. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants. Moms, can't live with them, can't find a great gift for him. It's madness, and it's the same every year. Mother's Day comes around, and it's like, what's it going to be this year? Another robe? Another candle? Slippers? A sweater? Flowers? We've got to do better than that, right? Well, you can, and it's actually the best gift you could possibly give a loved one. An Aura frame. Now, we have a policy to only do ads on our show for things that we actually like and use, and I gotta tell you, the Aura frame is probably the best gift I've ever given. The folks I've given an Aura frame to love it, and I love it too, Because when you give an aura frame, you're not just giving a person a bunch of old pictures, you're giving them new pictures. Every time you send one, do it. Right now, Aura has a great sale for Mother's Day. Viewers can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com, and the code is SCARVES at checkout to show your support for the show. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to... oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
Ben, what do we have coming up on the next episode?
The next episode is Season 7, Episode 17, MASH. While an alien archive transforms the entrepreneur into its ancient society, Data is taken over by several different personalities from the extinct civilization. Do you remember this episode, Adam?
That was one of your best Kevins.
Oh, thank you.
That was really great. I remember Data putting on a really stupid, like, headdress style, like the sort of thing you'd see someone wear at an outdoor music festival, like really stupid head mask thing that he can't exactly pull off. That's what I remember from this episode. The titular mask, I believe.
Yeah, the titular mask.
This is one of those episodes that the people hate.
Yeah, people cite this and Sub Rosa as the real bad ones from Season 7. I kind of like masks, TBH.
TBH, I didn't think Sub Rosa was as awful as I was led to believe, though it was very bad. I think when you approach an episode with a bad reputation, like, I think that's a good place to approach it from.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like Chris Pratt approaching the velociraptors, like with my arms up. That's how I'm approaching masks.
Okay.
I think this one can be trained.
You think it can figure out how to open doors?
Yeah, I do believe that.
Well, that's the next episode, Adam.
Gotta watch it.
If you would like to reach out to us in the meantime, there's a lot of great ways to do that. You can go to Twitter and use the hashtag GreatestGen. Adam is on there as @CutForTime, and I'm on there as @BenjaminRAHR. We also have very lively Reddit and Facebook groups, and of course there's the Greatest Gen Wikia, which has always got new and interesting information going on to it. Leave us a nice review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps raise the visibility of the program. And thank you to everybody who has left a review. We are really killing it in the Apple Podcast review game. Got like 1,200 something. It's great.
It's pretty great. Great to see. As we wind down the show, as it relates to the next generation, if you have not thought to contribute to this show's production, now would be a great time to do that. Go to MaximumFun.org/donate if this is a show that has meant something to you over the last few months.
Indeed. We should thank Dark Materia for our theme music and Adam Ragusea for a lot of other music here on the program. And with that, we will be back at you next time. Another great episode of Star Trek The Next Generation. And an episode of The Greatest Generation that is the Keymaster, and we're looking for that gatekeeper.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the U.S. Enterprise. Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
What qualifies as a TNG communion wafer? A Cool Ranch Dorito, I bet.
It's a piece of chocolate cake.
Yeah.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.